Good evening. My name is Benjamin Payne, as he has said. I live in Tampa, Florida, and this is my first time to the Gettysburg Bible Forum, and I'm very excited to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you, and I hope that what I have to say will stimulate your thinking. We have been given the opportunity as human beings to observe the world around us, and as Scott mentioned, there is evidence from the creation, I believe, that we can see all around us, a general revelation that we've been given. And that's our focus this week. The picture behind me says, design, loud piercing cry of design. And that's what we're going to be talking about. My topics tonight center around music. I spent 9 years teaching music, spent a lot of time studying music, and it's always been a fascinating topic, and one that sometimes gets overlooked in this creation evolution debate. And so I hope it's useful for you tonight. And I've got a lot of material, so I'm going to jump right in. In 1809, a philosopher and clergyman by the name of William Paley postulated the now infamous parable of stumbling onto a watch while walking in nature. Upon examination, he begins a series of logical deductions, summarized most simply by the notion that if there is a watch, then there is a watchmaker, some kind of intelligent designer of this thing that I found. Furthermore, that the watch, though ingenious, pales in comparison to the complexity and organization found in the known universe, which we have never observed purposeless nature to produce on its own without human-like intelligence. 200 years later, many people, including myself, still adhere to this basic idea, this basic philosophy that a watch has a watchmaker. It's so simply rational and does not require us to force evidence into pre-existing conclusions, as sometimes, I believe, evolutionists do. But lest I speak for an evolutionist, I would like to begin in way of introduction tonight with a clip from an evolutionist himself, and he mentions this idea. David Attenborough is a British man. I don't know exactly what he does. You might recognize his voice as the voice of the Blue Planet series and some of the other ones. But he did a series on evolution. He's a passionate evolutionist and created a BBC series. This is a clip where he discusses the human eye. I want you to listen to how he addresses William Paley and how he proposes to argue for evolution.
Was the argument put forward for the existence?
Let me start it over.
The biggest problem of all for most people was the argument put forward for the existence of God at the beginning of the 19th century by an Anglican clergyman called William Paley. He said, supposing you were walking in the countryside and you picked up something like this, you would know from looking at it that it had been designed to tell the time. There must therefore be a designer, and the same argument would apply if you looked at one of the intricate structures found in nature, such as the human eye, and the only designer of the human eye could be God.
Sam?
Just buffering, I can't do anything.
But you have magic. I might have to summarize it. There's a cool graphic.
If anybody is online, it might be helpful if you would go offline.
Evolutionists, man.
I think I need to give it up. Well, I'll just talk. Maybe it'll come back on. Let me tell you what he was going to tell you. So he says, the human eye, the argument goes, is too complicated to have come about by natural means and successive iterations. He said, but now We know so much about the animal kingdom that we know that, in fact, natural selection is how the eye came about. And then he starts to show animals that are have different kinds of eyes. So you see bacterium that have a sensitive spot on them and are swimming around. And you see a snail that has a sensitive spot that's indented. And then you see another kind of eye, and then you see another, the human eye. And they talk about that going from the simplest sensitive spot to the human eye, they have a computer graphic animation of that that looks quite cool and quite impressive, because you see this eye, say first there's a sensitive spot, and then if that sensitive spot was then indented, that would allow the light to be more directed into it. Then if that indentation grew into a bigger cavity, well, that would allow the eye to come and be focused on the back of that cavity. And then if mucus was in that cavity and then hardened into a lens, well, then you have a lens, and then you have the human eye. No, not the more effective, if you had watched the video. So I'm sorry about that than my explanation. But that is the crux of what he was saying. Well, I was going to ask you how you felt about the clip, but you didn't see it. But it's a very clever argument. Walking away from that, I thought, really? Is that all? It's a cleverly audacious argument. But this is, it's really, and I wanted to show it because it's an example of the basic evolutionary approach. And it's very true to what Darwin's approach in The Origin of the Species. Darwin himself said this: if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find out no such case. Well, of course you can't. Of course you can't find out any such case, because we're dealing with origin science. Origin science. And a level of mutation and change that we did not, cannot, and will never be able to observe. We've never seen it, and we never will be able to see it, because evolution as it's happening is happening so slowly that you'll be dead before you can ever see it. So it's something we can never absolutely observe. And this is the brilliance of Darwin. His foot is always wedged in the doorway, no matter how hard you try to kick it out. If you mention to him a case like the eye, which he discussed in The Origin of the Species, he can formulate a beautifully eloquent explanation for how small changes may have happened, and end by saying that it's not really that big of a change after all. And then to rebut that, you have to be practically an expert in biology to even know what to say. And that's exactly what happened in this video. He said, "We have an idea how the eye could have come about. You have this, and then this, and then this, and then this. There you go. You can't shoot our theory down." Now, in the video, he does use conditional language. He says, if this and if that. So I give him that. But this video and this approach to say that I can imagine how this happened proves nothing. Proves nothing. Because there are cavernous gaps between each one of those spaces. You can fill it in with computer graphics, but that doesn't make it so. The theory of evolution is specious. It sounds plausible, but that's because it primarily examines external features of organic forms and then speculates the transition between them without any forced conclusion or logical need to do so. Other than your imagination that there was a common ancestor for everything. That's the motivation to do that. It's more imagination than science. And speculation heaps upon speculation, and then that often gets mislabeled to the rest of us as evidence. This evidence, the evidence that we have, is the same for all of us, whether you believe in atheism or evolution or whatever. We all have watches in our hands. Watches all around us that we're looking at. And we're trying to decide where they came from. Now, when Darwin came up with his theory of evolution, he didn't know anything about biochemistry. Those discoveries had not been made yet. And so now, evolutionists have a much harder job to do. Because we find that before we think of mucus ever hardening on the eye, you have to deal with a complex chemical chain of events to make a spot sensitive in the first place. That is not a simple change. Events in that chain are often running in parallel and are codependent. So you can't just have one small change at a time. However, evolutionists still often propose the theory of evolution in the same surface terms, as though all of the molecular processes don't need to be addressed. By contrast, the principle of intelligent design is something we rationally conclude every day and throughout multiple fields of study. For example, if you're out in nature walking around and you see a bunch of rocks lying around like this, you wouldn't think much of it. However, if the rocks happen to look like this, you would know that someone came along and did something to those rocks, because you have never observed nature produce this on its own. That doesn't take any explanation from anybody at all. It's just something we do every day long. All day, every day. How about this? It's a bunch of rocks, right? Is this a natural phenomenon? These rocks just fell into place and some happened to fall on top of other ones. Or is that intelligent design? It's not that hard. And no matter what we choose to examine in nature, we come upon the same complexity and purposeful design. And that's what this series is about. And we hope that you leave feeling either strengthened in your conclusions or motivated to continue asking questions. This is an important matter. And it's worth all the time and energy you invest to get to the bottom of this. This answers the big questions. Why am I here? And where did I come from? But make sure it's an honest search. Don't just look for enough to satisfy a meager curiosity so you can get on with the rest of your life, or simply to justify what you already think. It's your life we're talking about, and it's a worldview that changes everything. Now, in my two lectures for tonight and tomorrow, with the time that I have that is quickly dwindling, I want to explore the question, let me get to the slide, why is music music to our ears? Now, that's a very big question, really, and takes a lot more than I have time to talk about. So really what I want to do is to impress upon you the literally incomprehensible complexity and efficiency of our auditory system in processing music, and of sound in general. Now, the eye has been kind of a bone of controversy in creation versus evolution, but I've not heard that much about the ear. And perhaps that's because the auditory system is one of the most complex and least understood systems in the body to this day. Technology advancements in the past 50 years have given us a little more insight, and now we can read people's brains some with PET scans and fMRI and EEG and MEG, and get some idea of the electrical signals that are going everywhere. But of course, there's still a lot left that is unknown. But there's enough that we can get an idea. Now, in order for us to appreciate the magnitude of our ears, we need to understand some things about the basics of sound and what we perceive as musical sounds. Now, if that sounds a little scary, I'm not going to get too technical. Okay, this is not a physics course. I'm not a physics major. But we need enough concepts so that we can even discuss it at all. It's hard to even talk about it otherwise. So here we go. You ready? All right, I need some water. Okay, so imagine you're sitting in a concert hall listening to the greatest violinist in the world play. There's three basic parts to sound experience, and this is not rocket science at all. There's an instrument, there's the air, and there's a listener, right? And to state it more generally, there's a source of sound that creates energy, there's a medium that transmits that energy, and there's a receptor that detects that energy. I see some people nodding your heads. It's probably the engineers and physicists that are going to know a lot about this, even more than I do. All right, so there's these basic parts. So for a lot of this lecture, we're going to assume that the source of this energy is a string fixed between two points, like on a violin or a piano, because it's easy to visualize that way. I think it's the easiest way to do it. Now, I imagine you know that air is nowhere near being empty, right? It's full of billions of molecules. And when the oscillation source is displaced, when it starts to oscillate, vibrate back and forth, it pushes the air against it. All right? And something that looks like this, if you're an Atari, something from the 1970s. So there's a string pushing air. Now, I have a better graphic than that. This one is much slowed down. Nothing happens this slowly in life. This is very, 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 very slow. But if you see, we have an energy source over here, which is like your string, which is pushing against all these molecules in the air, and they get squashed together. And molecules don't stand still. And when there's a higher pressure, you know, that creates, we have to go equalize to lower pressure, and so they spring apart. So this compression and decompression pattern is what starts this energy going, and it keeps going through the air. And so you can see these high levels of concentration. It looks like waves in water because of the graphic. Obviously, you don't see it in the air. And it's a longitudinal movement through the air. Now, if you look at these molecules here, the molecules don't travel with it. They actually are just staying in the same place, getting squashed and then moving. So they're kind of moving back and forth, but staying in the same place. So that's a basic sound wave. Now, in science, you have to have some way to graph something, right? You need a chart or a graph or something so you can talk about it. But we need to know how to look at sound waves on a graph so that we can talk about it. And it's really not too hard, right? This line represents equilibrium of the sound of the air pressure. Above the line, oops, I just hit something. What did I just hit? I changed the... This is going to be fun tonight, I can tell already. All right, so that sound wave above the line is when you compress the air. When you go below the line, that's the lower pressure. Okay, so you're going to go above and below that line. Everybody clear on that? All right, let's move on to the next slide. Now, we need to know some things about the sound wave, a couple of properties that we ought to be familiar with. One is the crest and trough, okay, which we won't talk about too much. But the distance between this equilibrium line and the top here and the bottom, incidentally, is the amplitude. Now that's kind of a word we use, right? Amplitude represents the intensity or the energy, and we hear that as loudness. Okay, so if you want to think about it, that's fine. So how much are these molecules getting smashed together? And then the other important thing is, notice the pattern. Do you see a pattern here? You probably already picked up on this, maybe didn't even realize it. So every second, this particular pattern is repeating, right? You have a compression and a decompression, and then you do it again. Okay? Patterns that repeat are called periodic vibrations, okay, because there's a period. All right? So just getting some language. Periodic vibration. And then we measure them in frequency down here, which is probably another term you've heard. So how many times is it doing this compression, decompression per second? All right, so we get the time element in there. So how many times is it doing this? Okay, now in this chart, we have one, right, which kind of doesn't exist. but this is just to give you the concepts. All right, you with me so far? Start throwing out language, and I'm like, oh no, okay. All right, some facts about frequencies. First of all, if it's a higher frequency, we hear it as a higher pitch. If it's a lower frequency, we hear it as a lower pitch. Okay? Just something to know. And a special relationship between frequencies. If you have a frequency, say 100, for example, and you double it to 200, in music we call that an octave. How many of you know what an octave is? Okay, good, a lot of you. Well, let me just play it for those of you who may not know. Do you hear how those blend together very well? Okay, we'll talk about why that is a little bit later. But that's what we call an octave, and I played the wrong note, so don't listen to that. but that's the relationship we'll mention later on. And then you should know that our human range of hearing goes from about 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. Of course, there are frequencies that exist in the world that we can't hear. There are some that elephants make, I think, that are below 20 that we can't hear. And then dogs can hear stuff that's higher than what we can hear. So that's still a pretty very big range, but there are things that outside of our range. All right, so that's what we need to know about frequencies. I just threw up some more pictures of frequencies so that we feel a little more comfortable with doing this. This one, if you counted it, this is 1 second, right? So how many periods are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm not going to keep going. So but that's how you would do it, right? So that's actually 10 hertz, which would be below what we can hear. This one, there's no way you can count it because it's 110. When you try to fit 110 of that into a second, that's why it starts to get messy, right? If you're depending on how far you're zoomed in. Okay, but 110 would be higher. We would hear that as a higher pitch. One other thing, class, as we're getting used to looking at these things, is the difference, making sure we understand the difference between frequency and amplitude. Okay, frequency was how many times it's doing this per second. So looking at the blue and the red waves, how would you compare their frequencies? They're the same, right? Because they're both doing a compression and decompression in that amount of time. So the frequency is the same. What's different? Their amplitude. Which one's louder? The blue one. Okay? So this would be someone playing the same pitch, or maybe two people playing the same pitch. One's playing louder than the other. Okay? Just so we get those concepts in our mind. All right. Moving on. Now, of course, in the real world, sounds, if you capture sounds, they don't look this simple. All right, this is very, very, very basic. In fact, they look more like this. Here are some musical instruments that we recognize, and they're playing a pitch, and here is an analysis of the sound. Is there anything that you notice about these patterns? You can say it out loud. They're repeating, okay? So initially, as opposed to, if I look at this, there's no repetition in that, right? So one of our first answers to the question of why music sounds like music to our ears is because musical sound has a repeating pattern. And I had some formatting issues. I'm just going to get used to it tonight. All right? Which is already kind of interesting in itself, right? The difference between music and noise is that I can identify a pattern in music, whereas I can't in noise. Now, do you consciously do this? No, you've never thought about this in your life, perhaps. but you do it instinctively. Your ear is picking up on these things. We're going to talk about how the ear is doing that in just a moment. Okay, so there's a pattern. But it's more than that. Now, let's talk about the ear a little bit. Parts of the ear and what the ear is doing. Let me check my notes to make sure. All right. So first of all, we'll go through this. We have the outer ear. That doesn't show up real well. Middle ear. In the inner ear. Okay? So, I'm sure you know some of this, but we're just going to review. So the outer ear helps pick up the sounds and funnel them in. And so without the ear, without the outer ear, we'd have a very different experience. Down the ear canal to the eardrum, the eardrum is only about 3/3 of an inch in thickness. 3/3 of an inch in thickness. How thick is that? It is oval in shape, being about 1/3 of an inch in height. Okay, it's not even an inch high. And 2/5 inch in width. It is stretched tightly over the hard frame of bone, similar to a drum. And unlike other membranes we encounter, even if it is completely shattered by the intense noise of an explosion or a gun blast, it will renew itself in a few weeks. It's regenerative. Now here's a quote from Sir James Jeans from 1937 about the eardrum. Our eardrums are sensitive to an almost inconceivable degree. The tiniest ripple in the air sets them into motion. Under favorable conditions, a sound wave of such feeble intensity that the air is displaced only through a 10,000 millionth part of an inch will send an audible sound to the brain. The change of pressure produced by such a sound wave is less than a 10,000 millionth part of the whole pressure of the atmosphere, so that the human ear is incomparably more sensitive than any barometer which has ever been constructed. The feeblest nodding of our head changes the pressure on our eardrums by more than is necessary to set them into motion. And if we do not hear a musical sound, it is only because we cannot nod our heads with sufficient rapidity. Some of you are going to go home and try that, like I just said. No. Right? So the eardrum is just an amazing instrument by itself, better than anything we have ever made or could, plus it's self-regenerative to throw into the mix. Now, after it hits the eardrum, oh, and by the way, we're going to watch a little animation of this. Hopefully, really hope that works. It goes to this middle ear with these three bones, the malleus and incus and stapes, hammer, anvil, and stirrup, which are amazing. And I hope you see the animation because to watch them move is quite amazing. The purpose of these bones is to amplify the signal. Did you know you have your own amplifier in your head? Like we have in a sound system? So, because the eardrum hits this bone, and then this bone hits this one, and this one pushes against that one. But your eardrum is very small, and so the oscillations are very small. And so the purpose of these bones is to make the oscillations bigger. Okay? And the stapes pushes against this shell-like thing, organ, which is called the cochlea. All right? We're going to get inside there. Too. But just looking at those bones and considering it from an evolutionary standpoint, how do you get to those bones by small successive changes? How do you even know to put them in that shape? Of course, knowing is not even a good word to use when it comes to natural selection because there's no purpose in it. It just happens. So how do you get those bones in there, first of all, and then shape them in just the right way to amplify the signal? Nobody knows that. Evolutionists don't have an answer for that. They're trying to find one. Right now, the common conception is that these reptiles that eventually turn into mammals had pieces of jawbone. There were small jawbones that eventually were not needed, and they eventually made their way into the ear and became these bones. I don't think that holds a lot of weight in terms of an explanation, but we don't have much else. Now, going to the cochlea, let's pretend that we take the cochlea and unroll it. That's the only purpose of this graphic, is to think of the cochlea as to unroll it so we can talk about it. Now, then let's cut it open from the side so we can see the unrolled version. Okay? Now, the partition in the middle, so here's the stapes. Oh, I did it again, Sam. Maybe, do you have another one of these back here? I have to keep my finger.
BJ computer one.
Okay. All right, hopefully I don't do it again. So here's the stapes pushing on the what's called the oval window. All of this in here is filled with fluid. Okay? I'm not going to get into more details than that, but it's fluid. So one reason you need to amplify the signal is because you're going from air to water. You know, water tends to slow things down. So you've got to, the stapes has to amplify that signal to get it into the fluid. Of course, it's not water. It's perilymph. Now, this in the middle is a partition between these two cavities. And along the bottom of this partition is what we call the basilar membrane. And this is where the magic starts to happen in this organ. So the waves come in here and they start pushing against this partition in the middle. Okay, so they're bouncing off everything and they're pushing against the basilar membrane and this partition. Now let's cut this in half. Okay? We're cutting that in half and we're going to look inside. All right? So here is the top chamber up here, and here's the bottom chamber, and here's this one in the middle. It's a partition, but it's also another chamber, somewhat triangular. And there's also fluid in here, a different fluid. And then here is the basilar membrane. The arrow is actually pointing to it, this blue strip. It's very, very thin. And on top of that is what's collectively called the organ of Corti. Which is kind of a funny name. Now, I'm going to take this part and zoom in on it just a little bit. And it's kind of flipped around. Okay, so here's the basilar membrane. Here's the organ of Corti. And let me find my notes. Okay, so the basilar membrane is stretched between the sides of the cochlear tube. It is only 8 thousandths of an inch in thickness and 1 1/4 inches in length. 1 1/4 inches in length total. So that's like, what, this much? Okay. And on top of the basilar membrane sits the organ of Corti, which contains 3 outer rows of 20,000 hair cells. These are cells with little bundles of hair sticking out the top. And 1 inner row of about 10,000. Okay, so those rows are coming towards you, right? Because we cut it in half. Okay, so this row of 3 and this row of 1. And ranging in length from about 1/15th to 1/170th of an inch. And then each of these bundles connects to a neuron, which runs out of the cochlea into the collective bundle of nerve fibers that goes to the brain. Okay, you following me so far? It's a lot of technical stuff. So the waves come in there, they bounce against everything. The waves push against the membrane, this membrane and this membrane, they start moving around, which push against the hair cells, which release an electrical charge, which goes to the brain. Okay, you with me so far? Now already it's like, what? Like, how do you even come up with that? Okay, now let's see if this animation will work, because it's worth seeing. Not this one. That one is still running, so how about I close that window?
Ears are constantly active. They pick up sound waves and change them into information that the brain can interpret, such as music or speech. Sound is a pressure wave that can vibrate either quickly or slowly. Slow vibrations produce deep sounds, while quick vibrations produce high-pitched sounds. Sound enters the ear and is directed through the ear canal, where it first reaches the eardrum. As the eardrum begins to vibrate, it sets the ossicular chain in motion. The ossicular chain consists of the hammer, anvil, and the stirrup. Sound vibrations move along the ossicular chain and into the inner ear. Within the inner ear, the cochlea plays a central role. It is here that the mechanical energy of sound is converted into complex electrical signals, which are then passed on to the brain. In simplified terms, the cochlea is a spiral-shaped tube filled with fluid. Sensory cells, also called hair cells, line the entire length of the cochlea. These hair cells have varying degrees of sensitivity for the detection of different tones or frequencies.
Refresh the page. All right, I'll take your idea. Oops, Xfinity is not what I wanted. Okay, where's my... Okay, it's in my PowerPoint. Let me go back. Seems like I have completely lost internet, maybe. It's asking me to sign in. Okay, well, you got part of the way. So what happens in the basilar membrane, and I've got a picture, even if that doesn't work. We'll go on. So in the cochlea, he mentioned that the cochlea translates. Okay. Let's see how we do. I'm refreshing the page. Huh? Oh, thank you. I ignore those kind of messages. We're trying. Okay, well, let me go back to my PowerPoint, and I have got pictures. So what he almost got to, he said that the cochlea translates these waves into electrical signals. Okay, so that's one thing to notice about this system. It's not chemical until it gets to the cochlea and it translates into chemical and electrical. Up until then, it's all mechanical. This is a mechanical system that uses physics. The eardrum is just moving. The bones are moving. And there's waves in this fluid that are bouncing against things. That's all mechanical. It's a machine that's in your head. That changes things. So how does the cochlea translate these chemicals, or not chemicals, the waves into an electrical signal? How does it know which frequency it needs to translate? Right? How does it even know that? Is it counting? Is it counting the number of these per second? So what actually happens is it comes into the membrane, and this is a picture of if you took the basilar membrane and you flattened it out, this is kind of what it would look like. All right? At the entrance over here, notice that it's shorter, whereas down here it's longer. Okay, well, first you've got a very geometrically shaped tissue here. Then, furthermore, this end of the basilar membrane is much tighter. It's tighter and thicker. This end is looser and longer. Okay? So this, and all, of course, there's hairs all over the top of this. So what that means is, now, before we discuss how this happens, we need to understand a basic principle of sound. So, for example, if you think about the strings of the piano or even a glass, if left to itself, any vibrating system has a free vibration, a frequency at which it will vibrate naturally. And you've probably done this with a glass. If you rub a wet finger around the rim of a glass, right, you'll hear a pitch. This pitch corresponds to the glass's free vibrations, the way it wants to vibrate. And so if you can produce a pitch loudly enough, in tune, in absolute tune with this frequency loudly enough, it's possible to make those molecules get so excited that the glass breaks. And you've probably seen that on something. And the same thing happens with a piano. If you put the damper down on the piano and get the dampers off so all the strings can resonate and you sing into it, have you ever tried this? Right? You hear some of those strings vibrating at the same pitch that you sing. Because those strings contain that free vibration in them. Okay? Your basilar membrane works partly along those same lines. So when the wave comes in here, it starts pushing things around, right? Those waves are pushing things around. Well, the parts of the membrane that vibrate at that frequency start to vibrate. So if there's a 440 hertz coming in, there's a wave that's 440 hertz long, the spot on the membrane that corresponds to that vibrates very strongly. Okay? And what happens when that vibrates, it pushes on the hairs, which are connected to those neuron cells, which then fire to the brain. Okay? But a 440 hertz will make this spot vibrate. Do you follow that? Your brain is using the way this is constructed to pinpoint the frequencies that are coming in. So if it's a higher frequency than that, if it's 500, it would be in this area called the resonance region of the basilar membrane. Okay? So is that amazing? I feel like it's like, what? We should all be like celebrating or jumping up and down or something, because let's pause there for a minute. How does that evolve in steps? So what would be a slight change that an organism needs to make to improve itself? Now remember, in evolution, natural selection keeps the improvements and only the improvements. Because if it's not an improvement, you're not getting better, right? So how do you make an improvement in an organism in your hearing? What do you do first? Grow a hair? Grow a hair, maybe somewhere in your head. Grow maybe even a bundle. I'll give you a bundle, okay? That you can experience a mutation that grows a bundle of hairs. Have you made an improvement? No, you just have some more hair. But that hair doesn't do anything, right? What does the hair have to, has to be connected to a neuron, which then there has to be a signal that goes to the brain. There's a whole lot of other parts to that. And so growing one piece of this is not an improvement. Or, okay, let's say you can grow a neuron. Well, now a neuron is not one step. A neuron is, I don't know how many steps, 1,000 steps, more steps than that. But let's say you could even mutate and have a neuron in your head. Is that an improvement? Well, you have an extra neuron, but what does it do? It doesn't. It's not connected to anything. It's not connected to your brain. It's not receiving signals. How do you know that that's an improvement? Why would natural selection select it? It's only an improvement if you have the end goal in mind. Right? If you know in advance that you need all these hairs on this vascular membrane, then it's an improvement because, you know, I'm on my way there. But if you don't know that, there's no improvement by forming one step of that at a time. That's a problem for the evolutionary theory. But there's more to it than that. But there's more. Because think about these hairs and the way things are distributed on the vascular membrane. If you lined everything up equally, if you lined all the hairs up and their sensitivities equally along the vascular membrane, in the range of human hearing, it would look kind of like this. So if you had 20 hertz down here, 20,000 hertz, and I'm just going to line it all up equally, 20, 21, 22, right? Just split the difference. Do you understand? So that would mean the halfway point, this spot was sensitive to about 10,000 hertz. This spot would be sensitive to about that, okay, if I just did it that way. That's not how the vascular membrane is organized. It's not that simple. And one reason it's not is because this would not help us very much. The reason is because most sounds that are important to us as human beings fall in the range between 20 hertz and 4,000 hertz. So if this was the way it was organized, where would most of our hearing fall? Right? In this little crunched place over to the side. What would be the purpose of the rest of this? I mean, we can hear those things, but it's not really useful. It's useful to us. So this is not how the vascular membrane is organized, though. It's organized this way. Oh, I want you to see my red X. There you go. No. Here's another view of the vascular membrane, kind of strip everything away, and just think of it as a long, thing. Here's the way it actually is organized. Down here, if you think 25, 50, is about here, 100, 200, 400, 800, 1600. Do you notice anything, first of all, about these numbers? They're doubles, right? So 25 times 2 is 50, times 2 is 100. Now, do you remember what we said about the relationship of doubles? What do we call them in music? An octave. Okay, so that has significance. Now, what does that also mean? It means that now, what's 2 times this? 3,200, and then 2 times that's 6,400. Okay, so that means from here to close to the end, like at least 2/3 of this now, is four sounds that we normally hear in life. What it also means that the vascular membrane is organized according to frequency relationships, not just the frequency themselves, but the frequency relationships to each other. Because if you look at these, can you see about how far they are physically apart? They're roughly similar distances apart, right? It's about 3.5 to 4 millimeters per octave on the membrane. What? How do you accomplish that? Did the vascular membrane know math while it was forming itself? How do you get into that configuration? That's a logarithmic pattern, not just a plain old... I mean, even if you went out, if you were walking along the beach and you saw some sticks that were lined up in order from longest to shortest, I mean, even that, you'd say, okay, somebody was here. But how about if they were lined up logarithmically? But in the ear, they are. And like I said, that gives us a better range on a membrane for sounds that are important to us. And it shows that something is going on here that's quite complex. I mean, what does it take to get some recognition around here?
right? What do you have to do in nature to say, hey, this is intelligent? But folks, that's only the beginning. We're out of time. Because we've only been talking about one frequency that looks like this. You know? Which, of course, in nature, they look more like this. And how often do you only hear one thing at a time? Moms, those you wish. Just one thing at a time. Very, hardly ever do you hear one simple thing at a time. And even if you're hearing an oboe play a single note, you're actually hearing a lot more than one frequency. I'll just leave you with that. That's tomorrow. That's tomorrow night. Okay, that's your preview. Plus, we haven't discussed anything that's happening in the brain, which is a whole other topic. We'll touch on a little bit tomorrow, but barely. So, I don't know what you've gotten from tonight, but I hope you can see, when we look at, take anything in nature, it doesn't have to be the ear. But you look down inside and you're just like, whoa, it does that, whoa, it does that. And we can relate to it because we understand the kind of intelligence it takes to make that kind of thing. Because it would take us 2,000 years to come up with something like that. And trial and error and trial and error and trial and error and trial and error. And we recognize that nature never produces anything like that on its own. We've never observed it. And so why when I come to origin science, do I need to abandon all common sense and logic that I use in every other aspect of my life? I don't think that makes sense. And I think God intended for us to see these things. So, all right, I appreciate your attention. I think we're going to take a quick break now. All right, would you like to watch this? I thought, we'll see if it goes.
For most people, was the argument put forward for the existence of God at the beginning of the 19th century by an Anglican clergyman called William Paley. He said, supposing you were walking in the countryside and you picked up something like this, you would know from looking at it that it had been designed to tell the time. There must, therefore, be a designer. And the same argument would apply if you looked at one of the intricate structures found in nature, such as the human eye. And the only designer of the human eye could be God. Anti-evolutionists maintain that the eye would only work if it was complete in all its details. Darwin, on the other hand, argued that the eye had developed, becoming increasingly complex over a long period of time. That would only work if each stage of development was an improvement on the previous one. And today we know enough about the animal kingdom to know that that is indeed the case. Some very simple animals have nothing more than light-sensitive spots that enable them to tell the difference between light and dark. But if a patch of such spots formed even the shallowest of pits, one edge of the pit would throw a shadow and so reveal the direction of light. If the pit got deeper and started to close, then light would form a blurred image. Mucus secreted by the cells would bend the light and focus it. If this mucus hardened, it would form a proper lens and transmit a brighter and clearer image. All these different fully functional stages at different levels of complexity are found in living animals today. This single-celled creature has one of those light-sensitive spots. Flatworms have a small pit containing light spots, so they can detect the shadow of a predator. A snail's blurry vision is good enough to enable it to find its way to food. And the octopus has an eye with a proper lens and can see as much detail as we can. So the structure of the human eye does not demand the assistance of a supernatural designer. It can have evolved gradually, with each stage bringing a real advantage, as Darwin's theory demands.
What did you think?
It's
pretty bold, isn't it? I mean, that's bold. I mean, he addresses the idea of a blind watchmaker, and then he kind of leaves that alone and just says, we know now that that's not the case. But what's the basis for knowing now? Because we've seen that happen? Or because we've imagined, if we line these creatures up, we can imagine how one changed to the next, to the next, to the next. None of that CGI is real. You realize that, right? We have never seen an eye form that way. And he was at least honest enough to say, if it did this, and if it did that. The problem is between a sensitive spot, the bacteria, and the next, there's a huge amount of changes. Huge amount of stuff that has to happen between those. And just because it seems like it might, could possibly have happened that way, and that we have a story that we can tell, is not evidence. It's not evidence. One of these questions here that I think I can address is, what kind of evidence would it take to make you believe evolution is more than speculation? That's a really good question. Maybe we can all ponder that for a minute. What kind of evidence would it take to make you believe that evolution is more than speculation? Well, for me, it would take more than speculation to make me believe that evidence is not just speculation. But evidence, or the macro theory of evolution, is speculation. Now, microevolution happens all the time. Microevolution is the same as variation within a species. If you think of the 28,000 kinds of dogs that there are, right? We can actually breed those animals and make them look different. But we've never been able to breed two dogs into something that's not a dog anymore. And we have taken the poor fruit fly. My dad did a lecture on this, I remember. We have spliced it, we have done genetic kinds of, we have ripped that thing apart. And it still is just a deformed fruit fly at the end. We cannot get it out of that state. And people have tried. But we have never, ever empirically observed a transition from one kind of animal to another. And since the whole theory of evolution rests on that basis, for me, I would want to see that happen, or have evidence of it happening. The evidence that evolution points to is the same evidence that intelligent design people point to, the fossil record. But if you look at the fossil record, it's fully formed animals. Fully formed animals are fully formed animals. That doesn't show a transition. All of that stuff in between is speculation. And it's not even a forced conclusion. Evolution comes from that Darwin looked at all the... And Darwin was an amazing student of nature. If you read Origin of Species, the man, he observed everything in minute detail. And he looked at all of it and he said, oh, this is similar here, and this is similar here, this is similar here. Well, that probably means that I could see how those all came from. And he used microevolution and breeding as the beginning point. Because you can see that, and you can see all the variety that comes. So then he extrapolated from that point to going from species to species, or from kind to kind. And so that was an extrapolation from that point, from what we have observed. And so I think that takes a lot more faith, especially with all of the information that has been revealed since 1859 that we know about biology. There's so much more that evolutionists have to explain. You can't just look at fully formed animals and tell me a story about how it got from there to there. A couple of the other questions I thought I might want to talk to whoever wrote it, because I'm not entirely sure what you mean. One of the questions had to do with how do you know, I think, when something becomes supernatural? Which is, I don't know if I'm prepared to answer. It's more of a theological, philosophical discussion, but it's something that cannot be explained by what we have observed in nature would tend to make you go beyond the natural into the supernatural world. I mean, this, and in the biblical account is a good example. And what's one reason people disregard the biblical account is because there's an example of the sun standing still. Well, that doesn't make sense from what we know of nature and what we've observed through science, or someone rising from the dead. I mean, those things must absolutely be supernatural. They don't exist in our normal everyday life. So to me, that would be the line for that one. Another one was, what about humans that have abilities that are improvements? And again, I think I might want to talk to you, get a little more clarification about what you mean. I mean, there's no doubt that there's variation between humans and other organisms. The challenge that I'm presenting is, how did that happen? That's the question. How did all that stuff get there? Not whether or not there's better improvements, whether humans have greater faculties than other animals. That's not the question. The question is, how did we get those faculties and abilities? So that's all the questions I had on the sheets. So I appreciate your attention, and we're going to continue this topic tomorrow night a little more. It's cool, so come back.